The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
This is case number 73 from the Blue Cliff Record. Matsu's 100 No's. And I'll begin with the editor, Yuan Wu's introduction. Here's Yuan Wu. In explaining the Dharma, there is neither explanation nor teaching. In listening to the Dharma, there is neither hearing nor attainment. Since explanation neither explains nor teaches, how can it compare to not explaining? Since listening neither hears nor attains, how can it compare to not listening? Still, no explaining and no listening still amount to something. As for all of you right here, listening to me explain here, how will you avoid this mistake? For those with the eye to pass through the barrier, as a test, I'm citing this old case. Look. And the case. A monk asked Great Master Ma, aside from the four phrases and the 100 negations, please tell me directly why Bodhidharma came from the West. The great master said, I'm tired today and can't explain it to you. Go and ask Zhizong. The monk asked Zhizong about it. Zhizong said, why don't you ask Master Ma? He told me to ask you. I have a headache today and can't explain it to you. Go and ask Brother Hai. The monk asked Brother Hai about it. Hai said, I don't know anything about that. The monk told Great Master Ma about this. The master said, Zhizong's head is white. Hai's head is black, aren't they? So, we have questions. And this monk has a question. We don't know who the monk is, but we know who everyone else is in this koan. Great Master Ma Matsu, one of the greatest of our ancient teachers, the one whose lineage became Linji Zen in China and Rinzai Zen in Japan, one of the great three great streams that flow into our Boundless Way tradition. Matsu, the one who introduced shouts and blows to Zen, the one who really wanted his students to wake up. And then two of his students, each of whom became an important Zen teacher in their own right, Zitong Zhizong, who we don't hear about as much, but who was a renowned teacher in the Tang Dynasty, and a great teacher, Baizhang Huaihai, who we hear about a lot, as in the koan, Baizhang's fox. And Baizhang is called in this koan, Brother Hai. So here's Matsu with these two disciples that are already quite senior and will become his Dharma heirs. He gave them transmission on the same day, would become his Dharma heirs and help transmit his tradition, which would become the Rinzai tradition to us. So quite a lot of teaching power packed into this koan. So we can understand our monks wanting to know something from these three. He starts with something that we don't want to get too hung up on, aside from the four phrases and 100 negations. Let's put all that aside. It doesn't terribly matter what all that is, but it goes back to one of the teachers who we just expressed our gratitude to in our ancestor dedication, Nagarjuna in India, who was very important in the formation of Mahayana Buddhism. And he taught through a negative way, tearing away, pushing away any positive philosophical claim. And the four phrases and 100 negations do this work and leave us with nothing, or rather leave us in this rich place of not knowing. And so what the monk is saying, in effect, is, I get the doctrine part. I understand. I can understand Nagarjuna's philosophy. Maybe he comes from another Buddhist school in China and has had all of this drilled into him and really understood it. I get that. I know what the official teaching is. But I gather that Zen, or at that time Chan, has something that is not in the books, something that's not written out, something they don't teach in the other schools, something that Bodhidharma brought to us from India. So yeah, aside from all that philosophical stuff, we just read the Song of Realizing the Tao that says, there's the leisurely one walking the Tao beyond philosophy. So beyond philosophy, even Buddhist philosophy, tell me directly, what is the essence of the teaching? Why did Bodhidharma come from the West? What is this Chan thing, this Zen thing? You're a great teacher. I want to know. I'm dying to know. And what does great Master Ma Matsu say? Oh, I'm tired today, and I can't explain it to you. Go ask Zhizhang. And so on. And so our poor nameless monk gets shunted from one teacher to the next, back to the first. No one will answer his question in the way he expects it to be answered. No one seemingly in this koan will address this burning question. And who knows how long it's been burning in this monk? Who knows how far he's journeyed to come to great teacher Matsu's assembly? And who knows how many days or weeks or months or years he's waited for this opportunity to talk to the great Master Ma himself, this wonderful opportunity. And here he is, just being sent in circles. Go ask him. Why didn't you ask him? No, he told me to ask you. No, well, finally going back, well, I did ask them, and they didn't tell me. I understand where this monk is coming from. It would be easy to be dismissive of the monk and take him as kind of a fool who doesn't get it. I don't see him that way. I find it very easy to identify with the nameless monk in this koan. This wish to ask someone when one is wandering and can't find the way. A few days ago, I was out in the woods, and I was hiking through the October mountain forest some miles west of here in Western Mass. And when I got there, I was a little surprised at how much snow was still on the ground. I was expecting a couple of inches. There was more like 5 or 6, which made it slightly challenging to stay on the trail, although there were boot prints sometimes, and sometimes they mysteriously vanish and then they would appear again. So there I was following the trail. There were white blazes most of the time. But there were also, thanks to this bitter, cold, and very windy winter that we've had, there were also lots of blowdowns. Not just branches that had fallen across the trail, but whole trees. And so those all had to be negotiated and made it still a little bit harder, because with every blowdown, the trail ahead would be blocked off, and one would have to find it again. And finally, at one point, I came to this gigantic blowdown, this huge old tree that had fallen and taken some younger trees with it, and making quite the barricade in front of the trail, blocking everything out ahead of it. And it was one of those so low you can't get under it, so high you can't get over it situations. And so there was only going around it, but it was such a detour going around it that I found myself unable to see where the trail was going ahead. So I had this idea that I would make a big half circle, and inevitably that half circle would take me across the trail and I would see it. I don't know what went wrong, but it didn't work out that way. Maybe when I thought I was making a half circle, I made a big S curve or some kind of lazy W something. But I kept finding myself in deeper and deeper snow and surrounded by thickets and uncertain of where to try next. And I did get a little bewildered. I don't want to use the word lost, but let's just say that I knew I was here, but I wasn't entirely sure where here was. And something rose up in me, not for the first time, and I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but here I am in the middle of nowhere, and the thought came up to me, I wish someone would walk by so I could ask them where the trail was. Which was such an absurd thought, because who's going to be out wandering in the snow in the woods midweek off the trail other than me? It seemed highly unlikely that someone would walk by like that. And it just rose up in me, and I let it go. And I was not anxious. I knew that there was a trail, and I knew that I would find it again. And it reminded me that this rising up of, I wish there was someone here who I could ask. I wish there was someone coming the other direction. Reminded me of when I was first a homeowner, something over 30 years ago. And I felt quite burdened at first by being a homeowner, at all the things that needed to be taken care of, and all the things that could go wrong. And of course, one after the other did tend to go wrong. That's what being a homeowner is partly about. And I had lived in rented rooms and apartments for a long time. And I had left my family home on the early side at 17. So I really didn't have much experience in taking care of things like the furnace when it would mysteriously go kaput, or what to do when the basement would start equally mysteriously filling with water from no apparent cause. And each time at first, in the early years, each time something like that would happen, what would rise up in me was I wanted to go, Dad! Because I had one of those World War II era dads who could just like fix anything, and nothing fazed him. And we were very used as kids to just something went wrong, just call Dad. Dad knows how to fix it. If he doesn't, he'll figure it out. If he has to call somebody, he knows who to call. And my dad at that time was still alive. It's not like I would get on the phone and call him. That would have been kind of pathetic. Dad, my basement's filling with water. What can I do? Well, I'm not here, Al, so you have to figure it out. I knew that that's what he would say. And so I had to learn that in this house, I was the dad. That was going to be my role. I had a partner who had many skills, a quite accomplished person, but they did not include things like dealing with broken furnaces and flooding basements. I had not chosen my mate on that basis. So something to think about for you younger folks. And so I had to take on that role, and I did. And I think it's, maybe some of this sounds familiar to you, this wanting to call out for help, even absurdly, to someone that isn't going to be there, to someone who's on the other side of the country. And I think it comes to us naturally because as children, all of us have been children, believe it or not. Every one of us is an ex-child. And most of us, and I hope in this Zendo all of us, have been lucky enough to have had at least one primary caretaker who we could count on to support us and to answer our questions. And we all lived through an early period of our lives where we only lived from day to day because of someone's help. And so it's very natural for us to want to ask for help, to want to ask someone a question. And I see all of that, I feel all of that in our nameless monk. This is a very human thing that he's doing. And when it comes to the most important questions for us as Zen practitioners, it just doesn't work that way. No one can answer that deepest question for you. No one. The greatest teacher, Matsu, oh my gosh, talk about the greatest teacher. The greatest teacher in China can't answer that question for you. What a dilemma. And yet, Yuan Wu in his introduction says, still, it's not nothing. Teaching and not teaching is not nothing. Interesting. And the Wado of this koan, we use the word Wado for the kernel of a koan. If you take everything extraneous away, what's the phrase you might want to sit with or live with for a while? The Wado is a little mysterious at first. It's when Matsu says to our hapless monk after he's been pushed this way and that way and gone in circles and been put off again and again and again. He says, Zhizhang's head is white, Hai's head is black. What one of the early commentators says, this is not about their physical appearance. And another commentator says, this is not about color symbolism. This is not about black and white symbolism. Don't get lost in that. But just, Zhizhang's head is white, Baizhang's is black. What's that about? So you may be wondering what happened to me in the woods. Or maybe you've forgotten already that story I started to tell you. But what happened was that, so there I was in a snowdrift, the snow coming just up to my high boots, not quite finding its way into them yet, and in some thicket. And I knew that I had crossed a stream shortly before I came to this barrier. And so I just started heading back towards the stream because though I didn't know exactly where I was in relation to the trail, I had not entirely lost my sense of direction. And so I found my way back to the stream and then I followed the stream. I think I had to follow it a little one way and then the other, further the other way. And eventually I found where the trail had crossed the stream and started back. went back towards the same barrier, intending to stick a lot closer to it this next time. And this is a strategy that I recommend to all of you, that when we hit a barrier in our practice and our efforts to get around it just take us further and further from the path, to just go back, start over again. So sometimes that might mean, if you're working through a koan, sometimes the teacher will say, you're on point three of the koan, let's go back to point one. Tell me how you answered the first koan point. Let's start over again. Don't think you're being punished. Don't think that you're being set back, that it's like being put back a grade in school. I know it's tempting to feel that way, but this is out of compassion. Let's start over and see where we get. It might mean going back to breath practice, to counting your breath, if that was your initial practice. And some of us who have been practicing Zen for many, many years will at times go back to counting the breath. It can always be worth considering that. When you feel lost, when you don't feel your feet firmly on the path, when you don't see a way forward. And sometimes it might mean, if you're doing koan work, going back to mu. Why don't we go back to mu for a while? Really? The first koan? The first one you ever gave me? Yeah. This is not a punishment. This is not a demerit. Sometimes we need to move back in order to move forward. And I also recommend not being upset. This was one of the things that I think kept me going in the woods the other day. I really wasn't upset. 20 years earlier, I would have been. I might have gotten a little frantic even, being worried about being lost in the snow. But I didn't, because I had confidence that the trail wasn't too far away, and that I had enough of a sense of direction that I'd find it eventually. And I recommend that as an attitude towards this practice, because it can get very opaque at times, and one can feel very lost, and we can feel that other people are getting it and we're just not getting it. Or we've been doing this for years and years, and why are we stuck at this place? And someone who is younger than us and joined the Sangha when we've been with it for years already is already a whatever, you know, has already been made this or that, and we're still this. All these things happen. And so important not to get upset and not to become anxious, but to have faith that the way is right there. It's a little different than my floundering around in the woods, because in one sense, our feet are always on the path. We just can't always see that. We just can't always make use of the fact that our feet are on the path. Can we really stray from the Zen path? Because where we want to be isn't some Appalachian Trail shelter 5 miles away. Where we want to be to do our practice is right where we are. No place we need to go to, no destination. It's we don't need something that's someplace outside of us. We don't need something from someone outside of us. As Wu Men says, the family treasure does not come in through the door. And this is what we all need to learn. This is one of the things that our koan is trying to teach us. And what does all that have to do with one person's head is white, one person's head is black? Well, I'm not going to tell you. I would be stealing your treasure. But I do want to leave you with that. So, I want to read you a poem, and then I'll read you the koan one more time. This is a poem by a contemporary of Matsu's, the great recluse poet Han Shan. My heart's like the autumn moon, reflecting from the clear, pure waters of the pool. There's nothing to compare. What can I say? And now our koan. Matsu's 100 no's. A monk asked Great Master Ma, aside from the four phrases and the 100 negations, please tell me directly why Bodhidharma came from the West. The Great Master said, I'm tired today and cannot explain it to you. Go and ask Zhizong. The monk asked Zhizong about it. Zhizong said, why didn't you ask Master Ma? He told me to ask you. I have a headache today and can't explain it to you. Go and ask Brother Hai. The monk asked Brother Hai about it. Hai said, I don't know anything about that. The monk told Great Master Ma about all this. The master said, Zhizong's head is white. Hai's head is black. Aren't they? Thank you. So let's move into our oval. And please feel free to sit comfortably. And this will be a chance for all of you to come forward with your questions, with your reactions, with your insights, with your perplexity, whether it has anything to do with the koan or my talk or not, whatever is coming up for you. Yeah, Laura.
What just comes off the top of my head is I feel like it was so generous of the teacher to keep answering like this, and answering them, just continually offering something. Like, I don't have as much, I feel bad for this student seeking out, but like answers on answers and just continually offering. And I just, yeah, I've been feeling that here in general, just the continual offering. Whatever it is, even if we don't know, it just keeps offering.
Yeah, and it's a funny kind of generosity, isn't it? Because they're basically saying, get lost, kid. Stop bothering me. Ask somebody else. Yeah. So there it is, right? How is that? I agree with you that that's so generous. And how is it generous? Yeah,
generosity comes in so many forms. And often we aren't able to recognize it when it comes.
David.
Well, the story in the koan got me reflecting on going on wild goose chases myself. And usually I don't need one of my teachers to send me on. I'm pretty good at sending myself on a wild goose chase. And there's something about it that sometimes when you're one, your wonderful wild goose chases, that you're not aware you are at first, which I think is true for the young monk. But when it dawns on you that you're on a wild goose chase, there's sort of something really wonderful about that. I've been trying to think, as I sat here, how to have a word for that or explain it. And I can't think of one, but it's kind of it sets you up. It sets me up to be back to beginner's mind, you know,
yeah,
or something like that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That. Wait. I don't even have to be doing this. Yeah.
I'm so glad you are doing it too. You know, I mean, we have to have that possibility of going away to be able to come back. Now, this isn't about, you know, go get lost in the woods in the snow as far as moment. And I think you're right. At least I identify with what you're saying, David. I can take myself on wild goose chases all the time. Mm. And, you know, I think there can be a judgment to that. Like, I can't believe I did it again. And so good. You know, we do keep doing these. To see where we get lost. Mm-hmm. It is in that opportunity lost or maybe not completely lost, knowing that you're here, but somehow out someplace where you didn't expect to be, then you can find right here. Mm. This is the answer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this wild goose chase took this monk right to where he belonged.
Exactly.
I was thinking as you were talking, David, that it's like that when your glasses are on your head and you're looking everywhere from in a Zen context, that really what it's like. And imagining this monk, you know, with his glasses on his head, going to three teachers, where, I can't find my glasses. Do you know where my glasses are? And they're all just looking at him. Why don't you ask somebody else? Yeah. Yeah, for some reason, right, the teachers can't tell you that the glasses are right on your head. Mm-hmm. You have to figure that out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Adam.
This resonated with me on a lot of levels. I like going in the woods. I've also gotten lost in the woods and had to find my way back to the trail. But the thing that I think really resonated with me was about your father, because my father was very similar in that he could fix anything, or at least it seemed like that to me when I was younger. And as I got older, I called him and relied on him. And I think at one point we were having a conversation and I came to the realization that he didn't actually know how to do all these things at all. You know, and in fact, I went back and traced back through my memories and I'm like, yeah, a lot of what I remember is him just figuring out how to do this stuff. Yeah. He didn't know how to do it, so he had to deal with what was right in front of him. And for me now, after practicing a bit, I've come to this thought that that he actually is a Zen master, in that he always dealt with the immediate thing that was the next thing that needed to be taken care of without getting caught up in a path or a story or a destination or any of those things. So I just really appreciate this idea that it's okay to not know because you're going to have to figure it out. Mm. And it's okay to not really have a path at all. There actually is no path. You're just dealing with the next thing in this moment and in the next moment and in the next moment. And that's all that is. And anything on top of that is, like we like to say, frost on snow. Yeah. So, thank you.
Yeah, not so much that there's no path, but that is the path. Mm-hmm. This and then this and then this. Mm-hmm. I was also thinking, as you were talking about, you know, this process of discovering what needs to be done, that's really the trick, right? You also, if your basement is flooding, you have to get down into the water. You have to be willing to just wade out there. And so you have to give up a lot of your ideas about what should or shouldn't be happening and what's appropriate and inappropriate for you to do. And you know, you splash around long enough and you see where the water's coming from. And that begins the process of getting something fixed. Yeah, even though you had no idea what you were doing when you wandered down there.
Right.
Yeah.
And I also think it's not about figuring it out and then we're done. You know, I think I'm at a point where I'm equally aware of what I used to know and I no longer know, and that what I actually know, whether doing, I was like, I used to do that. I can't remember what I did, but I used to do that. I think it's quick for me to point out that somehow that's a problem. Mm-hmm. Like I have forgotten. And this is not good. And yet, even when I did that one thing, so I've done a lot of electrical stuff in my house, which good news, bad news, I don't know. It hasn't got on fire yet. But I do need to replace a light fixture. And it's been so long since mm-hmm. I've done that. I was just like, I did all of these. How is it that I'm scared mm-hmm. of changing this one out? Mm-hmm. And I can notice that anxiety that comes up. Those things that I've never done, those things that I've done and I don't remember how to do it. It all of those are really interesting little stories that are coming up. And then just as Alan's saying, the path is, this is what needs to be done. And it maybe means that I call up the electrician to do this one. That is just as legitimate as me, you know, breaking out my tools again and digging into it. So I think this aspect of thinking that we'll ever figure it out is something just a slap, slap, slap. You know, I'm never going to figure it out in that way that I think figuring it out is. But if I'm open and if I'm receptive to meeting this moment, then everything is here.
So maybe figuring it out is the wrong term.
Well, right? it's
well, your story about your dad and Alan's dad, my dad was very similar. He would fix everything, and it angered me because we would always have old stuff. Everything worked, but all my friends had new stuff. We had an old car. But it occurred to me, not until I was an adult, how much joy it brought him to be there. Whether it got fixed or not, and it usually did get fixed, but the being there with the process of whatever he was doing, whatever the fixing was doing, it was there. That's where he was. And we benefited from it, even though I was too spoiled or ignorant to see that.
Craig.
I was thinking of Laura's observation of the generosity of the teachers. Mm-hmm. In the sense that ask a question like this, it would be very easy to respond with, well, here's a theory, here's a story, here's what so-and-so said about it. You know, I spent my career in academia where a student would ask and say, well, here's the theory, here's where it's been done elsewhere. But to say, you know, I can't answer the question, figure it out. And the wisdom to know when a more technical answer would actually help. I mean, because some things you don't have to figure out. Mm-hmm. That these deep questions and the restraint of the teachers, because I could imagine it'd be so easy to just philosophize and sit back and say, no, this moment requires not giving a direct answer. Mm-hmm.
And yet I really feel like Alan answered this koan very directly. Mm-hmm. You know, and it may not sound it, but this is very direct. And it may not be the answer that we who pose the question think that the way this answer should come back to us. Yet each of these teachers asking, you know, answering very directly, this is the generosity. This is part of the generosity, is that there's answers all around, you know, us. The world is responding to us, is answering us. I do think you're right, Craig. You know, this aspect, so easy to get stuck in that philosophizing or to get in this kind of how to fix it type mentality. And there is something about the importance of asking the question here as well. So don't want to dismiss that and then maybe just listen for the answers, that keep coming.
Yeah, and the temptation on the teacher's side to be the one who knows.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Bodhidharma.
Yeah, let's tell you.
Sure.
Yeah.
I've got a great little 5-minute Dharma talk on that. I'll give it to you right now.
Right.
You know, what a shame that would be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yet, so it's really tempting, and that's, you know, something that those of us who have been teachers in our day jobs have to unlearn that if we wanted to become Zen teachers. You know, and this, yeah. You know, I'm thinking of the koan. Don't you know that in all of China there's no Chan teacher?
Yeah, that's great.
I really also love this part where you talk about your dad, like, you know, just wanting to say, I wish I could ask someone for help. And my dad did not know how to fix anything. Like, he was like completely eccentric and didn't know how to do that at all. And I remember, but he had this way about him that was kind of like an adult, like you were kind of protected in some way, like you felt it. And I remember often thinking how, realizing that I was like a little kid and he was an adult and being like, what's that like? And I remember one time, I can't remember how old I was, maybe like middle school or something, but he was playing some music like on a record player, and it was this like music that his dad listened to. And all of a sudden he like got up and just like walked out, and I went and followed him, and he was like in the car just like hunched over, just like bawling, like crying, because I realized like how much he like missed his dad, and how much, even though he was this adult now, like he still like remembered what it was like to be a kid and like missed that feeling. And how I just liked in the talk how you took the perspective of this monk who, and you said it's relatable, because it is relatable. And so it's like there's some joy, or there's some reverence for being that way and not trying to get out of that, just to be that. So I love that part of the talk.
Yeah, the child that each of us was didn't go anywhere. You know, and I don't mean to talk about the inner child, but I mean to talk about, you know, habit energies, karmic patterns. Mm-hmm. Those are still there. And yeah, and so beautiful story of your dad just kind of reawakening, mm-hmm. Well, deeply feeling those habit energies of being the child. And now, you know, clearly alive for you, mm-hmm. Now that you have small children,
yeah.
You know, and that this has become a very patrilineal sort of discussion. You know, also moms and also, you know, older siblings and also grandparents and also aunts and uncles and older cousins. I mean, we carry all that with us. And you know how Dogen says that we don't say that the firewood becomes ash, the mm-hmm. firewood is still firewood and the ash is ash. And so we don't say that we became adults. The child is still the child, and the adult is the adult. Yeah. Ray.
In thinking about what you said and what she said, about, for me, maybe in a sense there is no mistakes.
Uh-huh.
Right? There's just opportunities to think differently about a situation. And when I think I got it wrong, mm-hmm. or maybe that's not it either. I got it right. Growing up with wanting to do it right is a mistake, mm-hmm. you know. But going with the flow of whatever arises, like you went on your trail, you could say, "Well, I made a mistake. I went around and lost track." But was it really a mistake? Or rather, an opportunity for you to figure it out and find a way to resolve the difficulty. So mistakes. place for me with my own likes and dislikes and preferences and what I think mm-hmm. I should do, rather mm-hmm. than what's meeting with what is showing up, in this case. And the monk kept looking for something that he thought would be mm-hmm. the correct answer, or the right answer, or not wrong. And what if they were all right answers? And the problem was that he didn't see it because he was looking for something to look a certain way.
Yeah, and I also want to say that the mistake would be to just stop,
mm-hmm.
right? The mistake would be just to freeze, and not keep moving, and with confidence that the answer is someplace. I'm thinking about that. There was a year that I did a week long hike in Maine on the Appalachian Trail. And I was seeing these posters up for a woman whose name was Geraldine Largay. And she had wandered off the trail, maybe to pee, I don't know. And she ended up just staying where she was. She got lost and she just stayed. She made a little camp out of brushwood and her tent and did not have, she was known not to have much of a sense of direction. And she died there. She just, you know, she starved to death. And it took them several years before they finally located her body in this tangle that is the northern forest in Maine. And so it is possible, I want to say, to make a mistake. But the mistake is to stay stuck.
Mm-hmm.
The mistake is to just go, I can't go any further. I'll wait for someone to, you know, as opposed to just something as simple as, well, I know the sun comes up in the east, and I was going north, you know, began going back to basics, going back to the beginning. What are things I know? I thought a lot about her because I must have walked within 3 miles of her. She wasn't even that far off the trail. There are stories of getting lost in the woods that have unhappy endings.
The what I was driving at is that there is in us an energy to move forward
mm-hmm.
anyway,
mm-hmm.
and for and to be true to who we are, we follow that energy where it makes sense, and if the energy says stay, then we stay. The energy says move, and it's very likely that you know, for many of us, we would have this energy that we would have to pay attention to, of
mm-hmm.
moving or staying till we are found by someone else. And life has its own agenda for us, and for sometimes that means this is where we meet our death.
Well, let's stay alive for now. and again, on the Zen path, it's not about waiting till somebody finds you.
No.
There's no rescue. There's no rescue outfit. There are no good Samaritans in Zen that are out looking for you in the Zen wilderness. That's a fundamental.
Yeah.
And again, the good news is, in Zen, on this path, it's always right under your feet.
Mm-hmm.
You're not 3 miles off the trail. You're right on it. So why don't we end with that? Mm-hmm.